Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here, taking a look today at the world of insects with Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist. He heads up the Insect Diagnostic Lab at UW-Madison. Great to have him back. Thank you so much for listening in. Every one of our lines is filled. We already have several emails and quite a few Facebook questions as well. But here's the number, 1-800-642-1234, email at talk@wpr.org, or go to our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show, and we'll get you on one way or another. Lots of interesting questions and some interesting pictures up there on the Facebook page today, Phil.
Well, lots of things going on. I mean, I always tease that my phone load is related to the outside air temperature. It's correlated. That warmer it is, the more the phone rings, and it's definitely following through this week. So,
well, what kinds of questions are you getting? What's the...
Well, locally, the big plague is we've got a millipede migration going on. And you know, I had a gentleman I talked to a couple days ago that would fill 3 5-gallon buckets with dead millipedes out of just his culvert alone.
And so
it's like a science fiction movie. And I mean, the good news about them is they're harmless. They live in the soil. They feed on organic matter. But they cruise around at night, and then they look for places that are cool, damp, and dark during the day, and so they're accumulating on cement slabs, you know, garage door floors, getting in, and in the sheer numbers, it's just a lot of waste. And honest, if you've got enough of them piled up dead, there's even an odor associated with them.
Yeah.
So most of the time, the source is, you know, a prairie or a long grass area close by.
You know, we had an email, speaking of insects, you see a lot of, Lee in Kakana said, my husband and I were driving north on Highway 41 Sunday evening, dusk, and we were passing the exit for Slinger. I looked out and saw hundreds of fireflies along the side of the highway. It was quite a show. We sit out on our front porch in the evening, and we will see hundreds of them. Is it a boom year?
Yeah, very much so. And it's interesting because a lot of people have told me that they, you know, the fireflies aren't like they were when they were kids. And you get a year like this, and I think this is an artifact of how lush things were last year, because a lot of things that the firefly larvae prey on do well when it's wet, things like millipedes and slugs and that kind of thing. And so I think we're getting the benefit. And it's been about 3 weeks, at least in the Madison area, that we've seen lots of flashing going on.
What about deer flies? Mimi in Reedsburg says, why are there so many this year?
Well, that may be the same relation. You know, deer flies breed in marshes and muck type areas, and so the more water there is, the more the maggots are successful, and again with things as hot as they are, they're just that much more active. I had one of our students send a picture back on, and he said he had caught 5 deer flies with one swipe of his hand, and it honestly looks like a cloud around his head. There's so many deer flies that are trying to attack him, and so I agree with you. If you're in the wrong spot, this is it's not pleasant during the day.
Absolutely not. Tom in Wanakee has a question for you. Let's go there. Hi, Tom.
Hello.
Hi, what's on your mind?
I have a question regarding the Japanese beetles. Just wondering how long they'll be around. I talked to Phil a couple years ago. I brought a clipping from a linden tree that I have, or I've got a number of them, and they were just devouring the leaves like crazy. And I've been using the Bayer tree and shrub for the past 2 years, and it's protecting the trees, and the Japanese beetles fall like rain. Every day I sweep up a bunch, and I just wonder how long they'll be around.
1st of September.
Okay, another month and a half then.
Yeah, typically it's 1st of July to 1st of September, and if we have a particularly slow year. I mean, I've seen them as late as the end of October, but I usually think things get better by the 1st of September. It's interesting. I'm getting a number of calls from areas that are just finally getting bad Japanese beetle for the first time. And, you know, Buffalo County, I got a call. I've talked to some folks in Green Bay, the county agent, BJ, up there. And that's the unfortunate thing is if you haven't dealt with this before, you have no idea of how intense it can be. You know, again, in the core areas, as we've talked about before, we've seen a reduction in the population, but it's still somewhat relative. At least a 2-month period of the adults. The one good thing I think about the dry weather, at least for us in the very southern part of the state, is that really slows down their reproduction in people's lawns.
Is that where they reproduce? Oh, I was wondering about that.
Yeah, but what we tend to find the biggest sources are in irrigated turf like golf courses. And my colleague Chris Williamson can find densities between 60 and 100 per square foot in well-irrigated turf in a golf course.
Well, this year it seems like I've got more than I had like last year falling. Right now, there's a couple hundred on the driveway or the the sidewalk. It's just pretty amazing.
Yeah, well, you may still be in that buildup. I've talked to folks in Oregon that have seen it for the first time in big numbers. It just depends where you're localized.
Okay.
In my neighborhood, they have been intense for about the last 10 to 12 years, but the last 4 years there has been a marked improvement.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks, Phil.
Thanks a lot for calling, Tom. Appreciate your call. David wondered on our Facebook page if he'd cut a few stalks of catnip and place them in the trees, the oaks and the and also in his blackberries because of the Japanese beetles. And he said he didn't have any this morning after he put that catnip out there.
Yeah, well, they're more of an afternoon critter. So
yeah.
It'll be interesting to see where he sits at about 3 o'clock this afternoon. They love sun. And usually, again, if you see the biggest activity in the afternoons, catnip has some interesting internal components that have some repellency to some insects, but a stalk like that will be interesting. My guess is he may be disappointed in the results because there's just not much going on there that comes off the plant. I mean, it's much like those mosquito plants that they sell that if you crush the leaves, they have a lemon-like citronella odor, which is a repellent. But as the plant's in the pot, it really doesn't do much good.
And there's not really much non-chemical other than knocking them off in soapy water.
Yeah, a couple things that are on the organic side. Neem oil is a product that you can apply to a lot of different things, including vegetables and fruits, and it is more of a repellent and an anti-feedant. And then the organic product, spinosad, has some effect. Both of them, though, are, compared to some conventional chemicals, not as good. But those are two at least organic products that can be used if people are looking for those kind of things to help them out. They last for 3 to 5 days, you know, which is reasonable. You just have to reapply them if the beetles are still around.
Mary in Whitewater has a question for you. Hi, Mary.
Hi. For the last month, I've been watching all those little white butterfly insects everywhere, and they don't stand still long enough for me to tell if they're a moth or a butterfly, but I'm assuming they're the cabbage moth, and are they going? What is their life cycle like in this moth stage? Are they going to lay eggs all over my cabbages, and then those will hatch into caterpillars? And I also have a comment later on about the neem oil and Japanese beetles.
Sure. Yes, they're a butterfly. It's an imported cabbage worm. It's been in the state since 1870. Only feeds on crucifers. They spend the winter in the chrysalis form. So I saw my first white butterflies in April. But really, we were doing a field walk in the West Madison field station last night, and they've got a bunch of cabbage. They really look very good. I mean, there's a few little holes. But it traditionally, it's the second generation, and we even get a partial third generation in some years that give us the biggest problem. And so I would watch. They lay little yellow eggs kind of elongated on the leaves, and you can see them. And then about 5 to 7 days later, they'll hatch, and that's the time you want to apply the bacterial insecticides like BT or some of these other products to protect it. So late summer is a lot of pressure. A lot of times you can get the cabbage and broccoli through the spring planting without really much in the way of worm pressure.
Since I'm not going to probably use an insecticide, should I just pick them off?
Oh, yeah. I mean, if you can. The problem is that they're so well camouflaged, it's hard to get them all, but it definitely doesn't hurt.
Yeah. Now, about the neem oil, when I got my first big influx of Japanese beetles, and they did come up out of the ground after a month drought, and then we got a huge rain, and that afternoon they were all out. They attack my three sweet cherry trees with a vengeance, and a Russian quince, and the flowers on my hibiscus tree, and that's about all they touch. I hit them with neem oil the very first second I saw them, and it did absolutely nothing. They just flew away and came back. So what I've been doing, and I don't use the traps anymore, what I've been doing is taking a big bucket of water and putting a little bit of the neem oil in it, and then I just hold that, you know, under them where they light, and you just tap the branch, and they fall in and drown. If I don't use the neem oil, it takes them ages to drown. But the neem oil kind of kills them fairly quickly as they swim around. But I've caught buckets of them on my fruit trees, and I just thought I'd pass that along because it's fairly easy. If you can stand, you know, looking at them clustered all over everything, and then if you can stand them bombarding you when they fall off the leaves and they land in your clothes and they miss the bucket. And when they miss, it seems like they head for the ground, and they either are going to bury themselves in the ground or they come back up, you know, as soon as they like the conditions.
Yeah, that's a defensive behavior of them to get away from birds and the things. And you could probably have a similar effect by just putting soapy water in there. What it does is it the surfactant activity gets the product in, and they basically drown quicker, if you want to look at it that way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, neem oil doesn't have a lot of straight toxicity. Again, it's usually more of a, they don't like the way it tastes.
Uh-huh.
And it has some hormonal effects, but that's a very slow-acting type of activity. We've had some success, but when the populations are very heavy, I guess, I know people are disappointed with the results.
Can you recommend a BT product for the cabbage worms?
Well, the most common stuff will be sold under the name Dipel or Thuricide, are the two common names I have seen. It is basically a strain of BT that we call Kerstaki, which is the caterpillar-killing strain. But the other option is this spinosad product is another organic insecticide that is very effective against caterpillars. And it is, you can find it in places like Gardens Alive's catalog, and I've seen it on a lot of the shelves of the local garden stores under Dr. Jack's Dead Bug Brew. They also sell a version of it called Colorado Potato Beetle Beater, Monterey's Fruit and Vegetable Spray. And, you know, this is a product that was derived from a fungus that was growing underneath a rum still in Jamaica, so it has a very interesting heritage, but it has very good caterpillar-killing strain, and again, because of its origin, it is organic, and so...
And Omri listed?
Yes.
Okay.
All right. Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call, Mary. And David in DeForest, we turn to you now. Hi, David.
Hi, Larry. Hey, Phil. Your previous caller just made me think of something else. When I was a kid, you always used to see the little yellow and white butterflies all over, if there was a puddle on the side of the road, or, you know, they were just everywhere. You hardly ever see them anymore.
Well, it depends. 2 years ago, I had lots of calls of people in the late summer that saw them. The yellow version is one of two different species of related to the imported cabbage worm. One is the alfalfa caterpillar, and one is another species in that genus. And what you're witnessing are the males going through puddling behavior. We think this is related to the salts in the water. And so it just depends where you're located. But as I said, we had a bumper crop 2 years ago that a lot of people would call. And even last year, pretty good. I mean, last year was a good butterfly year. This year, overall, I would say is not that good a butterfly year. I've had some people concerned about monarchs. I had seen my first monarch probably about the 10th of May, but I've definitely seen a big push in the adult populations recently. But so much of this relates to where you are, because, again, monarchs in the Madison area, I think, had been pretty few until recently, but I have had some correspondence with people in other parts of the state that say, they're normal, there's lots of monarchs. So,
when I was a kid, I just remember seeing them all the time, all over the place. But what I actually called about was whenever I scooped a litter box, there's actually two litter boxes, there's always a black spider in there, just a little bit smaller than a dime. He's very hairy, and I'll kill him. And next time, you know, 2 days later, I go and there's another one in there.
Okay, I'm.
What is it with spiders in the litter box?
Well, I bet you they're jumping spiders, and jumping spiders don't have real nests. They often will hide. You see them a lot in windowsills, and that just may be a decent place to get down and hide and kind of get out of things. They're a hunting spider, so they have to go out and search out their prey. You might even think, I'm not so sure they're that smart, but a litter box left in the right spot will attract flies, and that's one of their main prey. So,
yeah, there you go. Thanks a lot for calling. Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension Entomologist, our guest today. I'm Larry Mueller. Judith Sears-Poisson, our producer, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking insects today with Phil Pelletieri. Phil, we have several photos up on our Facebook page, and I would invite listeners, if you haven't gone to the page, go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page, and you can see some of these insects. Here's one from Gerald. New Holstein.
Yeah, sure, yeah. The critter is called a tussock moth, and one of the characteristics of many tussock moths are these what we call pencil hairs. They look like antennae, but they're really long hairs that are put together like a brush. This is the white-marked, or sometimes called yellow-marked tussock moth. You see it on apples, but you can find it on a variety of plants. Maples, in particular, rarely are there enough critters there to be an issue. But the critter itself is really very colorful with the red head and the different colored hairs and tufts and the like. And so it's a pretty neat critter.
Yeah. Here's another one from Stacy. This guy is pretty small. I've been finding a few of them around the house on occasion.
That's a braconid wasp, and braconids are parasites of other insects, some of caterpillars, some of beetle larvae. We sometimes see these coming out of firewood because some of their prey come from that. It's not a stinging wasp as far as people are concerned, and they're usually relatively host-specific, and so they're attacking only a small group of insects. And there are dozens of species of braconids. There are dozens of species of a related family called ichneumonids, and they're always beneficial, at least in the sense that you know that the only thing they can attack are other insects.
And she, Stacy, included one other photograph.
Yeah, and to be honest, I think that's where the braconid wasp came from. That is a wasp cocoon. And many of the braconids have striping in there, and so I can't say for sure the two species are related, but that is enough of a relationship that that may be. Now, what happens with a lot of these parasites, they're maggot-like, and they will crawl out of their prey and spin their cocoons down. And so, as I said, there may have been a caterpillar that had a bunch of braconids, and that's the interesting thing is one caterpillar can generate 40 or 60 braconid wasps. And so maybe all of what she's seeing is from a caterpillar that was parasitized and died in her windowsill.
And let's see. Let's go to John in Milwaukee. Get John on here. He's been waiting a while. Thanks for waiting, John. Hi.
Hi. Good morning, Larry and Phil. Thank you so much for taking my call. I have a what I'm thinking is a possible ant infestation to my house. And what I'm seeing is at the very edge where in the inside of the house, in the basement, where the brick foundation meets the wood frame, right there at the brick base of the foundation, there's a little hole, maybe the size of a small straw or stir stick, in which some particles are being pushed out, kind of a dark brown or light brown, in two different areas. And I'm only thinking it might be an ant because I did have sweet ants in June and May, and I took care of those with the poison. But could this be carpenter ants or something else?
Well, it could be carpenter ants, could be pavement ants, it even could be odorous house ant. Those are all three species that potentially nest indoors. And, you know, it's worth trying to treat in those holes where this is coming out from. If the nest is located right there, you've got them. The only caveat to that is sometimes where they're dumping things could be a few feet away from the nest, and then that treatment won't quite get us there. Because what the secret with any ant is to find the nest and treat it. And so, as I said, I would consider getting just an ant spray from the hardware store. What I often suggest in this case is look for one that has that little red applicator that reminds me of the WD-40 straw.
Yeah.
So that you can spray it up into these places, and then we see what happens. And if the activity stops, we probably have won the war. If not, then you just have to poke around. It can't be that far away.
All right.
Give it a shot, and thanks very much for calling. And Donna in Burlington, on to you. Hi, Donna.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm calling because I have two dogs, and whenever I let them out, one of my dogs, my larger dog, gets his ears just totally chewed up by these biting flies. They're not deer flies, I don't think. They're very triangular in shape, and they're mostly brown with a little bit of black, and they're filled with blood when I smash them.
Mm-hmm. They're probably stable flies because one of the names of that is a dog ear fly, and they love to feed on the dog ears.
Is there anything that I would be able to put on my dog to help repel them?
I've talked to some people who have had some luck with putting Vaseline or similar products just to give it some physical protection. The permethrin sprays that you get work a little bit, but that's kind of a tough application because it's up on the face. Unfortunately, as your dog moves around, that's what attracts them. They're attracted to movement. And the breeding site of stable flies is typically rotting vegetation, like bad spent hay that's wet or seaweed. But one of the curiosities we found is that the breeding site could be from 200 miles away. It doesn't have to be local at all. And so when we get bad years from them, it's tough. It really is tough.
There. So gasoline would really be the only thing to put on his ears?
Not gasoline, Vaseline.
Oh, Vaseline.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, no, gasoline, right. No,
no
way.
Don't do that.
I didn't think so. Okay.
All right, thanks a lot for calling. Back to Facebook for a minute. We have Bill sent this email and a photo. We have a bloom of many-legged worms the last 2 days here in Eagle, Wisconsin.
That's the millipede that's keeping Phil busy.
That's the millipede for sure.
And, you know, it's tough because the source is often off your property, and people sprayed the wrong spots. If you're going to go through the bother of spraying, think about where all the organic matter is. And so if there's a big field next to you, it's not where you mow the lawn, it's where that big field and all that dead grass is accumulating. And to apply a product, you need a lot of volume. And so a hand sprayer or an aerosol can isn't going to get you there. A hose end attachment would be potentially adequate. Or you can call a commercial company that would go through what's called a power spray, where they're putting a lot of volume on. But then the realistic side of it is if you kill 90% of them, sometimes the numbers are so high that people are still going to be disappointed. They're still getting in their pool. They're still getting in their basement, those kind of things. And the good news is it won't go on all summer, but it may continue for another week or two. And as I said, I really have been very impressed with the number of complaints I've gotten for about the last 2 weeks on the millipedes.
Another picture here on our photo. Terry emailed this photo. I've noticed these insects on my hosta flowers appear to be removing or eating the pollen off the pollinated flowers. What are they? And
okay, that is a critter we would call a hover fly. You know, the reason I can tell it's a fly is it only has one pair of wings, but it's striped just like a bee. It turns out that many of the hover flies utilize pollen as a food source. And so they are both pollinators to a degree, because when you get in mixing up the pollen, they visit another flower, they can transform it. One of the things that you'll see with hoverflies many times is when they're flying, they'll sit there stationary and just beat their wings. You notice most of the time bees don't work that way. Bees tend to come and go from places.
Right.
And sometimes they're incorrectly called sweat bees. There is something totally different to an entomologist that is a sweat bee. But the family is Syrphidae, and there are large numbers of species of these, and they're all small to middle-sized and often bee-striped in one form or another.
Another Facebook question from Sharon. We've been seeing hundreds of tiny orange butterflies this past week. They're in Douglas County. Don't have a photo of that, but orange butterflies.
Well, one thing that we see at times, there is a European skipper. Now, skippers are kind of in between moths and butterflies. They tend to be small, and the European skipper is orange in color. Honestly, the populations came to us from Canada originally. They are occasionally a pest of timothy in some grasses, but that's relatively minor. But they do feed on a wide variety of native grasses. And so, as I said, I wonder if you've got a big population of European skippers.
Sue in Rice Lake, thank you for waiting. Hello.
Thanks. Love your show.
Thank you.
Last night when I just got home, I noticed a small blue butterfly in my driveway, which I've never seen before, wondering if you had any thoughts about what it might be. I live in northwestern Wisconsin, and I have never seen any blue butterflies up here before.
Is it a bright blue?
It was a bright bluey, blue to lilac color when its wings, and it flitted around really quickly.
There are a lot of blue ones.
Yeah, there's probably at least 8 or 10. There is a site called Butterflies of Wisconsin, and if you go to that, there's pictures of really all the species you would see, and you can go through it. There are some butterflies we do call the blues. There are some hair streaks that have some grayish or bluish markings in them. And I said, if you go through that, so you might get a general idea, but honestly, to give you a species idea, you often have to look at the hind wings and the number of dots and whatnot, so it gets a little subtle at times. So I'm sure it's out of that group. But exactly what species, I would have to see a picture.
Yeah, and I did do a little checking on the internet, and I really couldn't identify it. It moved around a lot. It finally sat for a little bit and folded its wings up, and but it was still really hard to identify. It was a small butterfly. I had never seen one of that color before. It was very beautiful.
Yeah, I would definitely, with the wings open of some of those blues, they almost rival, you know, when I think of a big blue bright butterfly, it's those tropical morpho butterflies that you see in Costa Rica and the like, and the blues of these almost rival it. It's just that they're the size of your little fingernail, whereas these other ones are the size of your hand. So,
well, I'll check that website out and see if I can't do some identification.
Yeah, there's a gentleman by the name of Mike Reese, and Mike is just an incredible photographer. And aside from the butterflies of Wisconsin, he has a site to the tiger beetles of Wisconsin, which are very difficult to take pictures in nature, but he has done that. And now he's taken probably the ultimate. He's trying to get pictures of the robber flies of Wisconsin, and they're a very nervous, very fast-flying creature. And to get a picture of even a couple species is impressive, but as I said, Mike's going out and trying to get every species we have in the state. So he's something else.
You know, somebody told me about, I forget who it was, a photographer, I think, a friend said, if you're trying to get a picture of a butterfly with its wings open when it's sitting, you should shade it. Because they will open their wings to get more heat, is that?
Well, butterflies often use that trick to get their body temperatures up. It works a little bit better when we're in a cooler period, because sometimes they're trying to generate enough heat so they can fly. And so they often, we call it sunning themselves. And so, again, that's part of it. And, of course, the more surface area you've got, the more heat that you will bring in. And it's been kind of fun. You know, the one thing about this warm temperature, it really gets the moths and things out. I was bopping around yesterday morning, and next to a screen door, I saw one of these great big Polyphemus moths. And so I got lots of good pictures of that one before I took them in the woods to try to get them away from the birds. But these digital cameras, it's just such a delight to have the opportunity to take pictures of some of these things in nature.
Yep. Well, thank you.
Thanks a lot, Sue, for calling. And Dewey in Butternut, Wisconsin, on to you now. Hi, Dewey.
Hey, gentlemen. I hope I don't lose you. I've been waiting a while here, and I'm in a bad area. But my question goes back. Oh, Christ, sometimes when I was a young man, 45 years ago or better, I was on a turtle flammable forage doing some frog hunting, and I had an encounter with the largest bee I think I've ever seen in my life. It had a big, round, silver head with about a 2-inch body, and I asked a buddy of mine what he thought that might have been, and he said it was a silver bald-faced hornet. I've never heard of one or seen one.
Well, bald-faced hornets are the critters that make those basketball-sized paper nests, and they are black in color, and they have a kind of a white face, and then a little bit of a whitish or creamy-colored marking on the end of the abdomens. But, I could think of a couple other things. With almost the size range, you start wondering about, there's a huge horsefly that we have here that has great big silvery eyes and the like. And
it wasn't nothing like that, but I'll tell you what it had. It had a perfectly round head and a long, narrow body on it, but I'd say a good 2 inches from head to tail, and it just hovered right there staring at me, and I thought I was about ready to drop in the water.
Yeah, well, see, I mean, that's that behavior reminds me, is that just if you get a chance, look under black horsefly. Because it is three times bigger. It doesn't even look like the normal horseflies we get into. But the bald-faced hornet is a very common native insect. And as I said, it's the one associated with. But 2 inches is getting a smidgen big. I mean, I would think normally about an inch and a quarter.
Yeah, I'm looking around. When I heard this thing at first, I thought, well, there's no airplanes normally flying around up here in northern Wisconsin. By golly, I tell you what, and there he was at arm's length. It scared the heck out of me, I'll tell you.
Well, the one thing about the black horsefly, it doesn't bite people, thank God, because it would kill you.
It was looking at me pretty good. So, all right, the black horsefly.
Black horsefly, yeah.
Black horsefly.
Black horsefly, I'm sorry, yeah. All right, fellas, thanks a lot.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling, Dewey. And Chris in Grafton, thank you for waiting. Hello.
Hi. I just have a question. We have a finished basement in about a 15-year-old home. And, of course, in the summer, we're not down there a lot, but then the weather turns bad, the kids go down there. And we routinely have what I would almost call a spider nest, big web underneath, like, edges of cabinets, where there's just a pile of waste from the spiders. Is there any effective way to put something down there to control the spiders?
To be honest, I think you do as effective a job of getting the vacuum cleaner out, put an attachment on it, and just get around all the corners and edges and do that once, maybe twice a year. I find that really more effective. It's interesting that many of the sprays are kind of disappointing. In fact, some people would argue that a dust is better than a spray because the dust gets on the web, and then when the spider goes through it, it gets contact. But again, I go back to, I've had as good luck with just the vacuum cleaner in taking care of it, because you're removing spiders from the population that are the breeders, and so that will have a longer-term effect.
Mm-hmm. All right, that sounds super. Thanks much.
Thanks much for calling. Appreciate your call. Email from Conrad in Mineral Point. What's up with the carnivorous gnats out this year? Sure, they've been a real nuisance. You don't actually feel them bite, but overnight you develop a very nasty welt. That itches like crazy.
Well, Larry knows these real well. These are black flies.
Yeah.
And it has been a very good year for black flies. And it's a group of insects. They're about the size of a fruit fly. They're also called buffalo gnats because they do have a little bit of a shoulder to them. It's like a fruit fly that's been pumping iron. And it's interesting because there's a number of the species. Most of the species are bird feeders. And we've talked, I think, earlier on the show about a lot of the bluebird people in the southwest part of the state have had major bird losses because of the black fly feeding. I'm going to be very interested to see what the DNR says about the turkey hatch this year, because I have fear again in the southwest that there was enough black flies that we may have a lot of young bird mortality associated with them. And, you know, we've talked to people in La Crosse. There is a big river species that came off both the Wisconsin and in Mississippi River that is a partial story here, but there are other species involved. And again, it has been a very good black fly season. And you described the bites classic. You don't feel the bite. It's often around the hair or neckline. Sometimes you develop a little trickle of blood, but often people will develop a nasty welt, like somebody knocked you with a hammer, and it will last a number of days. And they always breed in moving water, so it's got to be rivers, creeks, and streams. But they can blow a pretty good distance away. And so, again, some people are complaining just the gnats flying around and not getting bit. Those are usually the bird-feeding species. But there are a number of them that will also feed on larger mammals. Dogs in particular, too, you know, biting around the eyes, biting around the in the same kind of thing, often a trickle of blood. You don't feel the bite, so it's not like a deer fly or a stable fly where it's, you know, the big pain right away. And that's the reason you react is they're injecting all these anticoagulants and anesthetics and other things in their saliva, and that's what your body reacts to, and that's why you develop such a nasty welt.
Carolyn emailed and wonders, can earwigs fly? I'm pretty sure I saw this happen. Yikes, she says.
Well, as a family, there are a number of flying species, but the European earwig that we see here is the wings just aren't developed enough to expect that. And so there are some other critters that are somewhat similar in looking. So it wouldn't have been a true earwig in Wisconsin. If you were in Arizona or you were down in Florida, there are some species down there, that some of our native species, that do fly, but not this exotic European earwig that is found throughout the state. We have no native earwigs typically in Wisconsin. So
another follow-up question on fireflies, email from Ann. She was walking past a little local cemetery just after sunset. There were tons of fireflies. It made a cool and eerie effect, like souls ascending. How come fireflies mostly light as they fly upwards? Why are they mainly out at dusk and are not visible later at night?
It's an activity thing. I mean, there are fireflies out there, but they're basically most active right at that dusk period. And, you know, the flashing patterns can be used to identify them. It's usually the males that are up advertising and flashing and flying, whereas the females will often sit stationary and then answer back. And so it's kind of a visual way of finding your mate. Yeah, I the same thing. So if you want to go looking for fireflies, that's exactly when you want to be out there, is just at dusk. And you come back a couple hours later and things have pretty much quieted down.
Kathy emailed from Eau Claire. On the bottom of a big milkweed leaf, I saw many tiny caterpillars, like maybe 100 on one leaf. They were dark in color and bristly. Mm-hmm. Ran in the house to take a picture, and my battery was dead in my camera.
There is a critter. Now, earlier we talked on the Facebook page, there was a yellow-marked tussock moth. Well, there turns out to be a species of milkweed tussock moth. So it is exclusive to milkweed, and usually the moth will lay her eggs in clusters, and so you get this colony of little worms feeding. And as they get bigger, they get kind of a grayish undertone with a little bit of brown and black markings in them. And again, very fuzzy, and they have these characteristic pencil hairs that the tussock moths do. Really don't do much. I mean, some people would argue they're taking food away from the monarchs. Well, there's more than enough milkweed out there, so that part doesn't hurt. And the moth itself is, as many moths, not very impressive. It doesn't have much in the way of markings, but the caterpillars really are quite photogenic.
And Gail in Brownsville emailed, we have quite large black hairy spiders that look something like a tarantula.
Mm-hmm. Well, the two big spiders that we have in the state, there's a group we call fishing spiders, and then the other group are the wolf spiders. And so anytime I hear about tarantula-like spiders, those are the ones that they likely are. And they're nighttime hunting spiders, so they're out cruising a lot, and they end up in places, look big and scary. But you know, my rule with spiders is the bigger and the scarier they look, the more harmless they are.
Conceivably, this one has a white spot in the middle of the back.
Okay, well, that probably could be one of the fishing spiders, because they tend to be more ornate, a little bit more striping in the legs, a little bit more markings on the body. But again, if you do a search either under wolf spider, and there's a number of species of wolf spiders, some that are almost white in color, some that are gray, some that are black with brownish stripings. But the fishing spiders tend to be, as I said, more marked with yellows and whites on the body.
Marge in Oconomowoc, it's your turn now. Hi, Marge. Thanks for waiting.
There. I live in a nursing home, and for the first time in 10 years, we have an infestation of spiders on the fifth floor, which is kind of unusual, except that we have also a lot of birds, swifts, that have built their nests up there on the fifth floor. Now, what is the connection between the birds and the spiders?
Probably not much. What I see on the other side is that Most spiders are attracted, they like insects to feed on, in which you find a lot of times when we have our lighting on at night, you're drawing insects onto the building, and the spiders take advantage of that. So a lot of time, depending where the security lighting and whatnot is set up in a building, influences a lot. And just like people in lakes, it's the worst thing to have a big security light in front of your door on a lake, because there's so many insects that come off the water that are attracted to the light. You draw them there. And so the worst spider problems I see are, again, next to lakes.
Well, we are on a lake.
Okay, well then.
That is very interesting. Yes. I'm so glad I called.
Thank you for calling, Marge.
Thank you.
All right. Appreciate it. Marge from Oconomowoc. And Mary in Richland Center, on to you. Hi, Mary.
Hi, guys. So glad to hear this show this morning. I have earwigs, and I don't know what to do about them. I don't know where they're from. What is their purpose in life?
Where okay, are so they?
Is the problem in the house or outside?
Inside.
Okay.
Oh, they're outside, too,
yeah,
on
but
the doorstep.
The ones that come inside are the dumb ones. Well, not really, but, I mean, there's nothing to eat. They can't live indoors. But earwigs are like this millipede problem we talked about earlier, is they're out at night feeding on things, and they are primarily plant feeders, but they do feed on aphids and other things. So we call them omnivorous, so they eat lots of different things. But when the sun comes up, they're looking for places to hide that are cool and damp.
Right.
And so they'll get under flower pots and, you know, anything you have outside, you often will find earwigs. But that forces some of them in by accident, and that's what people get so annoyed about. And they don't hurt anything, but they're creepy. I mean, they act like cockroaches. They're honestly
right.
Not that distantly
related.
They're
one of the very few insects that I kill.
Right. But the other side of it is, you know, even though we all have an aversion to them, they don't hurt anything. I mean, other than marigolds. The one plant that I find that they will run across your lawn to feed on is a marigold. And so there are people that have to spray their gardens to protect their plants. In my household, they feed on my white clematis, not my purples. So they eat all the petals off the flowers. They look just terrible, and it's all earwig feeding. But the inside, you know, when they're getting in a lot of numbers, I talk to people about checking your door sweep to make sure that it fits tightly, to make sure that everything, your piping and whatnot outside, is caulked in. And in the areas that are so dry, like Madison right now, one of the things that you will find is that they're drawn to your water hose because they're looking for water.
Right. Well, and inside it's the dog's water bowl.
Right, right. And so then once they get there, if that water pipe is not caulked in, there's a little seam that they can crawl into, and then they end up in the house. But it's not even worth spraying in the house because, as I said, they're not going to breed. You just kind of clean them up. People that insist they have to spray, you can spray along the outside foundation and try to kill them before they get in with various chemicals. And they show up about the Memorial Day. To be honest, I usually find when we get to about the 1st of August, their numbers really start to drop. But again, I would not be surprised that what is increasing their immigration inside is they're looking for water, because things are getting pretty dry out there.
There you go. Thank you very much, Mary.
Thank you.
Appreciate the call. Email from Jeff from Hudson. We noticed a gold-colored beetle in our raspberry patch that we hadn't seen before. They don't bite, but they're eating the raspberries.
Have to see it.
Yeah.
It isn't quite there. I don't know if this is a Japanese beetle and they're
it
just describing
like
it differently. You know,
because they can look gold.
Yes. I'm just, they love raspberries, so there's often that relationship, although they would prefer to feed heavier on the leaves than on the fruits itself. But if they're just feeding on the fruits, boy, if you can get me a picture, as I say, I'd be happy to look, but it just doesn't ring a bell off the top.
Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. If you have a chance, go to our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show, because there are lots of really cool photos of insects up during this program as we visit with Phil Pelletieri. Phil, we've got one from Donna, who found this dead in a spider web in Manitowish waters last year. What's that?
That is the cast skin of a dragonfly. Some people would call it a dragonfly nymph. Others would call it a naiad, which is just an aquatic nymph. And that's the skin that they molt behind. And if it was successful, it transformed into the adult dragonfly, and that shell is left behind. On the other hand, the spider could have caught the nymph before it emerged. I can't quite tell from the picture, but and they are prehistoric looking. And, you know,
really,
I know that the birds
cool
get, Dr. Craven will probably give me grief here, but I think the dragonfly should get far more credit for eating mosquitoes than some of his birds.
And we've got Lorraine. Here's a critter eating her hollyhock leaves.
Right. And the characteristic of this is that long snout. That makes it a weevil, which is a family of beetles. And there is a hollyhock weevil. aside from eating the leaves, what is primarily more of a problem, it feeds into the flower seeds, and it lays eggs, and the grubs eat the seeds, and so they are a seed pest more than anything else.
And Judith tells me that Mary emailed this photo from her mail route just south of Duluth, Minnesota.
Yeah,
it beautifully. That is a really cool.
Right. This group of spiders we call crab spiders, and you can kind of get that impression by the way they sit. Quite characteristic. They are white or yellow in color with pink markings, I mean, which is kind of odd.
Really cool.
But you can see that this is a very good camouflage if you're sitting in a flower waiting for a bee to come by. And that's one of the tricks you'll see. You'll often see crab spiders on particular flowers. And honestly, some of them can change their color to a degree to match the flower. And as I said, whites and yellows and pinks are quite common, and they're great photographic subjects.
Diane and Viola, thanks for waiting. Hello.
Yes. I have an accolade elm that's pretty old, at least 20 years, and there's holes in rows all over the bark. I can't see an insect.
Yeah, if it's a very defined row, it honestly is not an insect. It's sapsucker feeding, which is a bird. Their feeding looks very much like insect bore holes, but you know, when we have wood borers, they tend to be much more random and not clustered, whereas sapsuckers often have lines of holes, even lines going up and down, so you almost have a box with, you know, 60, 70 little holes in it. What you do for that is to put some hardware cloth over that site so it stops bleeding sap, and that's what the sapsucker's after, and hopefully it'll move on. But elms are quite common. Birch are quite common to see this. Even lindens.
Up the whole trunk and all the branches.
Yeah. Well, the bird's been busy. And, you know, if those things heal, it's okay. In some cases, do you worry about that as being much like a scab or a scar that we have that are sites for secondary infections of both, you know, bacterial problems and in some cases insects. But that's definitely what it is.
It looks like it's in good shape. Is it going to kill it?
Usually not. Only, again, as long as you don't get a secondary problem associated with it. But
mm-hmm. There you go. Thanks, Diane. Gene in Knapp, Wisconsin. On to you. Hi, Gene.
Hi, yes. I've got a barn. And I've got both, it appears like both powder post beetles and the old house borers.
Okay, the old house borer, I would say probably not. I've only seen one in my career. They're typically not found closer to us than Indiana. They only get into spruce. We don't have the right circumstances. That's one thing you can cross off. To be honest, though, the treatment for both of them would be similar. I think this is a case of some of those borate treatments, like the Timbor or Boracare, painted on the wood. It diffuses in, and it's a stomach poison. So when the larvae come out and feed on the surface, they ingest it, and it kills them. And being the chemical is called sodium octaborate, so it's a form of boric acid that's a little bit more water-soluble. And so it's a relatively non-toxic product to deal with. One would not want to eat it because that's the problem even in people, is boric acid is a stomach poison in people. But as they said, the old house borer, I don't know if there's somebody else rooting around in there, but we don't have any big cerambycid beetles, which is the family they come from, that attack seasoned wood. Most of ours are things that you find in dead trees. They come out a couple years after they attack the tree, but they can't get back in it because the moisture content drops. That's what makes the old house borer so unique. But it's really more of a European species, and again, we find it in North Carolina, South Carolina, but the closest the normal range is, and the only case I saw in Wisconsin was a home where they had imported logs from North Carolina.
Ah, there we go. Thank you very much for calling, Gene. Appreciate the call. And Joshua in Black Earth, on to you. Hi, Josh.
Hello, Mr. Larry Miller. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was just wondering, whenever I go outside of my house and start picking raspberries, there's a little raspberry patch beside a field by our house, so I go out and pick those raspberries, and I'm wondering, I get these, when I'm done picking them, I'll soon after get these little double bites. It's just one bite is bigger and one bite is smaller, and they're right next to each other.
Okay, well, the one thing, excuse me, that I always get nervous about raspberry patches is that's one of the few places you pick up chiggers in this state. But chiggers usually are a delayed process that it often takes hours before you see the reaction. One of the other characteristics of chiggers is often the bites are lined up in confined clothing spaces, the belt line, the sock line, that kind of thing. Other than that, you know, there's lots of miscellaneous things you can run into. So I really, without seeing, so I assume you're not feeling the bite, but you see a reaction.
Well, actually, I start feeling just like after being out there 5 minutes, I'll start feeling an itch. And then when I get inside, which is like maybe 10 minutes later, I'll start seeing the bite, and it's on my forearm and elbow where most of the time.
Okay. Hmm. Then, not totally sure. I guess I would say, look, chiggers are big enough to see. They're little tiny red mites, and there are other mites that are red that aren't chiggers that you can run into. But they're about the size of a period in a newspaper, so they're pretty subtle. But boy, without seeing the critter as it's biting type of thing, it's a guess. I always tell people that, you can make an educated guess by where the bites are, how many they are, where you've been. But I don't know anybody that can 100% and even 50% diagnose a bite just by its appearance, because we all react differently and the like. In fact, there are things that present like bites that are not. If you've got a center puncture mark, it's usually pretty obvious something was after you. But if it just gets a hive-like reaction, you even wonder if it's not an allergic response to something.
Yeah, could be. Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. I appreciate your call. Email from Bill in Madison. Are we not at the prime year of the 13-year cicada this year? Will there be a great hatch? Will there be loud buzzing? Will it be fun? Or does that depend on your point of view?
Okay, well, two things. We only have 17-year cicadas in the state, and their emergence was about 5 years ago, 4 years ago. It wasn't in Madison anyway. There is a population down in Iowa that's emerged, but the 17- and 13-year cicadas come out usually in the end of May, early June. What people are hearing in the trees right now are what we call dog day cicadas, and there's at least three species you can run into. They have a 2 to 4 year life cycle, but there's some out there all the time. And they typically show up in the middle of July through September. The other thing I'm seeing, there's a big wasp called a cicada killer that we're seeing in the Madison area. It's the biggest, meanest wasp you have seen. And that's the females sting the cicadas, dig a hole, burrow, put it down in there. But what people often misread is that the males are very territorial. So you go by a flower bed and this big wasp comes and stares you right in the face. And being a male wasp, they can't sting. And so people often, I think, get too excited about the potential problems that cicada killers cause. I always tell people that if you got stung, it would be very unpleasant, but I dare you to catch one. It's just not a simple thing. So, kind of the interesting things, and this is one of those, I make this quote all the time on the show, unfortunately, that the governor moved us to Missouri and didn't tell us.
Yeah.
When I was a young graduate student, we never saw cicada killers here. I'd have to go to Indianapolis. That's where you find them, is south of us. But now I'm finding cicada killers, at least in the southern two tiers of counties, and this is another one of those examples that the lack of cold weather in the winter is allowing insects to move northward.
Luba in Madison, on to you now. Hi, thank you for calling.
Well, thank you. I have two things that aren't really terribly important, but I have my nose to the ground pretty much so, and there is a spider that seems to be carrying a little white ball, and it's very tiny. And that's one thing. I don't know what they do, what they eat, or anything.
Well, it's probably the egg masses. There's a number of these wandering spiders. You think of a spider that makes a web, she lays her eggs there and can protect it. But these ones that don't make a nest that are out searching literally have to carry their eggs with them. And so it could be a small wolf spider. There are some other ones that do it. But that is basically an egg ball, I'm sure.
And what do they eat?
Insects.
Oh, they do?
Yes.
Okay. And then I've noticed something I've never seen before. This summer when I'm working on that lawn, I see tiny little tan bugs. And they almost are like ladybugs, except they're completely tan. And if you touch them, they fly. So that, and they're a little narrower than ladybugs. They're not round as much.
Yeah, beetles are tough because we have thousands of different kinds of beetles. I don't know if it's a type of leaf beetle. Be honest, there are some small species of coccinellids or lady beetles that we could run into. The question would be, if you could try to see what they're associated with. If it's a particular weed that you see them on. Or are there aphids around? I mean, there's got to be a reason they're there. And, I can't think of any beetles that would just feed on grass. So there has to be another part to the story of why those beetles are present.
Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And Mark in Columbus. Hi, Mark. Thanks for calling.
Hi. I am positive that the beetles in my raspberries are the Japanese beetle, and I'm wondering how to best deal with them.
It's a war. I mean, as we talk about on so many different plants, the problem is that they're flying in from down the road and they're highly attracted to those plants. So you've got no control of the breeding population, which is the way we normally would want to deal with insects. Three or four options. Some people in smaller patches will literally put a floating row cover, which is a protective barrier, because these beetles don't like to go underneath things to feed on them. And so just physically keeping them off. There are some chemicals. It's quite interesting that the bear tree and shrub insecticide has a label for applying to raspberries, but you have to put it on, I think, 21 days before harvest. And that's a systemic chemical, and so it will prevent the insects from feeding on the leaves. It doesn't translocate into the fruits to any degree, and that's why it's allowed to be used. But that would have had to be applied way back in early June to be effective.
What is that called?
Well, Bayer, B-A-Y-E-R, the people that make the aspirin, have a number of insecticides. And the product, it's the active ingredient is called imidacloropid. This one would be their fruit and vegetable spray is the one that allows you to put on raspberries. And again, you drench it in the ground, and the roots uptake it. And so that's, for a person that uses synthetic chemicals, that's an acceptable product. For the organic side is where we get caught a little bit in that we've talked before, the neem oil or the spinosad-type products have some effect, but they don't last for very long. And so you have to reapply and reapply and reapply. But that's just, unfortunately, the state of what it is. Mm-hmm. We would tell you, don't bother with the traps. They will draw more beetles into your property than give you more of a problem than if you don't have traps. So, and unfortunately, you know, this is going to persist.
And thanks very much for calling. Coming up, we'll be talking about the squash vine borer and other things with Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. We're taking a look at the world of insects today with Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist, Larry Mueller here. Thank you so much for listening in. Join in with your own questions at 800-642-1234. Go to the Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show if you want to post a picture or post a question there. That'd be fine, too. Marlene and Racine's been waiting a while, so let's go right to Marlene. Thank you very much for calling. What's on your mind?
Yes, I found a small little green worm when I picked the raspberries. It almost looks like they've burrowed into the raspberry itself.
Okay, there is a raspberry fruit worm. It's a beetle in the adult stage, and the larvae will feed into it. Could be a couple other possibilities. Unfortunately, this late in the game, you know, the proper time to shut the door is really before, just as the fruit's starting to set, because that's when the eggs are getting laid. Usually not serious enough. As I said, you kind of throw the berries that are infested out and stuff and don't have to worry about it. If it got very persistent, again, that's what you'd have to gear up next year is to spray after things have bloomed, but just as the berries are forming, because that's when the beetle is laying her eggs, and then it develops into the larvae that shows up in the fruit.
Okay, so would I spray the plant itself, or use something that you put into the ground?
No, in this case, you have to spray the plant itself and get coverage of the plant. The systemics wouldn't do you any good.
Okay.
All right, thanks for calling. Jim in Manitowish Waters, hello to you.
Ah, real good. How are you today? Hey, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I really need some help.
Okay.
I'm charged with collecting deer ticks for a research project for a laboratory down in Milwaukee. And after walking through the woods in a sweatsuit, dragging a white flag, and setting out CO2 traps, I haven't had a lot of luck, aside from getting, you know, chewed on pretty good. But I'm looking for thousands of these things. The reason is that I guess there's only like 3% of the deer tick population that contains this specific virus that this group's looking for. And I was wondering if you might have any suggestions as to where one might procure that amount of deer ticks.
You have to look at a different area. I mean, I you're doing everything right to look for them where you are, and they're just not there in the densities.
I've been over, I understand they're over between Spooner and Hayward, which is where I've been. Here again, without much luck, what I have done is hooked up with a sportsman's headquarters store, one of the hunting in Minung, trying to get, you know, some hunters thinking, well, maybe I can get some hunters to, you know, comb their deer, their bear, whatever. I'm even offering to pay them to do it.
Yeah, it's still going to be tough because those things will be attached to the animals, and honestly, when they remove them, they'll probably kill them if they can remove them at all. It's interesting because when you talk to hunters, you know, right now we have mostly the nymphal stages, which are quite small and you know, when I tend to see a resurgence is when we get the adult transformations about the middle of October. And then again, if you drag in a good spot, you know, people can get 50 an hour. But where those good spots are somewhat hard to predict, other than I always tell people, pretend you're a grouse hunter. the kind of thickets and stuff that have raspberry understory in some foliage above are the typical places you see the highest densities. Okay. You know, Governor Dodge Park down here has often had some pretty good populations. But I said it can be real spotty, and you know, we're starting to find in the Madison area, surprisingly, we have not been able to find ticks in the arboretum previously, but we are finding them this year. You know, we do see some of those changes, but again, I think you're doing things right. You're just not getting into places that have high densities.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling, Jim. Appreciate it. We have an email from Bondwell, Wisconsin. Doris, as a matter of fact, and that has to do with squash vine borer. I always get her buttercup squash. I know the moth is black and orange and darts around rapidly. Does it lay eggs under leaves or on the main stem? Do they hatch and then pierce the stem to enter it? How do you get destroy it?
Well, you know, the eggs are flat, brown. They remind me of very small dishes, and they're usually laid towards the base of the stem. The moth comes out usually about the last week of June in Madison. The farther you go north, that would be delayed. We often correlate the moth activity, if you've got any chicory flowers around, when the first chicory flowers are seen, that's when the moths are flying, and they're still flying now. For conventional chemicals, 7 sprayed on the base of the plant is very effective. For organic chemicals, I would trust this new spinosad product as being very effective. The problem with the bacterial insecticides like BT is the just as you described, the insect feeds immediately into the plant. So you need a contact kill, not a stomach kill. And that's what the problem with BT is. It stays on the outside of the plant, and the insect doesn't feed long enough on the outside to be exposed to it. So usually I would say, you know, somewhere around the first week of July, get the first application on. If you had historic problems with high populations, a follow-up about 2 weeks later. But once you start getting into early August, we're kind of past the egg-laying time of that insect.
An email from Michael in Appleton. We were sitting in the yard this weekend around dusk and noticed what looked like a water spout or tornado. Flumes of insects swirling around. There were 2 to 3 flumes that we noticed about 30 feet off the ground and about 20 feet tall. Any ideas what they were?
Well, they're definitely swarms, and my guess is there's some kind of fly, and if I had to take a guess, the lake flies are a group that do this quite commonly, but there are other species of insects that will, usually in low wind conditions, and what people talk about, these are clouds of males, and they're mating swarms, and then the female will come in and select a mate out of it, and a lot of times you will see the swarms congregate over the same item, day in, day out. You know, it's always 3 feet above this one garbage can type of thing.
Yeah.
You know, you'll see pictures on the internet sometimes that, as you say, I mean, it looks like a tornado. I mean, the columns are, you know, 30 feet wide and 100 feet high. I mean, it's just amazing the biomass associated with these. Most of the time, though, I associate them with aquatic insects. Not always, but so if I had to guess, those were lake fly swarms. Again, basically what's going on is people tease it's the insect equivalent of a dating bar, but the females are selecting mates and then going on from there.
And another interesting firefly question from Mary in Madison. The fireflies in my yard in Madison flash yellow and seem to flash once. At Governor Dodge State Park several weeks ago, they seemed to flash a blue color with some flashing once, others 4 or so more times. In the past, along the Mississippi, there were several varieties of color and flash patterns.
Yeah, different species. And we have, you know, I don't know what the official number, I'm guessing, though, we have at least 8 or 9 species in the state. It might even be higher than that. And so, yeah, the different color tones, although I usually see them mostly as yellowish green to yellow. But, you know, I think we sometimes describe colors somewhat differently. But if you know the flashing patterns and what, and the males and females do have different flashing patterns, also, but if you get to recognize them enough, you can identify them purely by their flashing patterns and colors.
Caller in Oshkosh wonders what he should do for long-term control of red aphids in his garden.
The big red aphids that I see are typically associated with various sunflowers and other composites. To be honest, they don't do a lot of damage. They're really quite colorful. And what happens with aphids so often is just about the time that it looks like they're getting serious, there's so many beneficial things that come in and eat them that the populations collapse. So unless the plant is showing wilting, yellowing, stunting, so it's showing signs of major stress, I don't think it's worth doing anything. It's better to let them come under natural control. We do have pretty good luck even getting out there with a hose and having at them and just literally hose them off plants. And aphids are not overly hardy in the sense of that they can climb back up and really get things going. If you have to, as I said, there are various, you know, garden insecticides, but most of the time in prairie situations and whatnot, where I see these most common on coneflowers and that kind of thing, I just don't see them get serious enough to warrant doing anything.
And caller in Green Bay wonders if there are natural predators that could be used to control mosquitoes around her horse barns.
not really. I mean, things like dragonflies and robber flies feed on this, but nothing that I know that can be manipulated in a sense to be able to concentrate them to do you some good. And so, unfortunately, you know, aside from providing fans and things so that you get enough air movement, the mosquitoes have a harder time. There really isn't much of a practical thing that one can do.
Mike in Mazamani, we turn to you now. Hi, Mike. Thanks for waiting.
Hey, great show, guys.
Thanks.
My daughter captured a very menacing-looking millipede-type bug that had 10 legs, 10 jointed legs. It's about 2 inches long, maybe an inch and a half tall, very menacing-looking creature.
Well, probably more likely a centipede. I mean, the difference to an entomologist is that millipedes have 2 pairs of legs for every body segment. Centipedes have 1. Traditionally, millipedes are more cylindrical and centipedes are more flattened, but there are some that kind of cross that line. The difference is that millipedes feed on organic matter, are totally harmless. Centipedes are predators by nature, so they are kind of like lions. They have to go chase their prey down, and that's what would make them somewhat menacing. And the most common one we have, we often refer to as the house centipede because it's a tropical species that's only found indoors. It has a number of big gangly legs, incredibly fast moving. That's the other thing, is millipedes don't need to be fast. They're kind of slow, you know, loping along, so that might help with the identification.
Oh, okay. Do they bite?
Centipedes, if handled, can bite. But I often dare people to catch one. We have some outdoor species that are more of a kind of a chestnutty brown, you know, and if they're in leaf litter, and they're not as fast, so if you pick one up, they could bite. You know, it's not even a bee sting type of bite, but, you know, anytime something bites you, it gets your attention, but definitely nothing dangerous about it. Now, in the tropics, they've got some centipedes that are 18 inches long, and if one of those bit you, I think you would have the venom is such that I think it would not be a very pleasant experience.
There you go.
We have it in a jar. I won't handle it. I'll let it go.
All right. Sounds like a plan, Mike. Thank you for calling. Appreciate it. Mike in Mount Pleasant, your turn. Hi, Mike.
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
Hey, a couple years ago, I had some very thin worms or caterpillars on a long, needled pine-type shrub, and they were in about a 2-foot localized area, and I'd say the population was at least 200,
mm-hmm.
and they were very narrow, and I walked by them, I don't know how many times before I noticed them move, caught my eye, and what I did then is move my hand close to them, and they all move together in unison like a school of minnows.
Right. Those are sawflies. And sawflies, there's a number of species on conifers, although we do have species on broadleaf trees. And one of the common phenomena is they cluster together when they feed. They have this defensive mechanism that they all move in unison. And honestly, they're literally secreting substances out of their mouth that help protect them. I can't tell you what species without more background, but there's a number that feed on the needles of pine trees, most of the time, not enough to get out of hand, but there are times that we have trees that are 100% stripped under the right conditions. And so I know you had a species of sawfly. The adult is basically a primitive wasp-like creature. It has 2 pairs of wings rather than 1 pair, and that's why we don't consider them true flies. The larvae, though, look caterpillar-like. But the adults, again, are really wasps, but they don't have a stinger. The name comes from the fact that the females have a little saw-like egg-laying device that they literally will cut and inject the eggs into plant stems or into needles and the like, and so that's where the name comes from.
Okay.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. And Jim in Fountain City, hello to you.
Hi. Say, thanks for the show. I built a little pool in my backyard with a circulating pump and little waterfall thing going on there, and noticed the other day that even with this moving water, I've got some mosquito larvae growing in it.
You sure they're mosquito larvae?
Well,
The only reason I ask is, you know, there's so many little aquatic maggot-like creatures, and typically mosquito larvae, in most moving water, you just don't find them. They're more stagnant water. Now, mosquito larvae have this tube-like breathing tube that sticks up, but I also have drain flies and a few other aquatic flies that have similar larvae. And so any question, you can put them some rubbing alcohol and send them to me. I could verify it real quick if that was the case.
The associated question I have is, I kind of took it for granted they were mosquito larvae. So I did some searching on the web and discovered a substance called Bacillus thuringiensis.
Yeah, but it's the Israeli strain. We call it BTI for short.
Yeah. Will that just works on mosquito larvae? Or?
Yeah, it's a very selective product. It's very good for ponds and the like because you can have fish and other things in it and not affect them. It is a stomach poison that they ingest, and it basically shuts down their digestive system, and that's how it kills them. So that is an option, but if it turns out to be the maggot of some other fly, to be honest, these things are not as broad spectrum. But if it's not a mosquito larvae, you probably don't have to worry about it. So.
Oh, yep.
Okay. All right. Thanks.
Yep. Thanks a lot for calling. What about Darcy here? What's on your mind? Hi, Darcy. Thank you for calling from Brookfield.
Thanks for taking my call. I have milkweed that I purposefully grow in my garden for the monarch butterflies to lay their eggs. I can't seem to find any that get any longer than maybe an inch at the most. Do they have a predator?
A whole bunch of things. And the other side is that as they start to mature, it is very characteristic of the larvae to migrate off the plant and make their chrysalis somewhere else, which is probably a defensive mechanism. But they have virus diseases that kill them, fungal diseases, assassin bugs feed on them, Asian lady beetles feed on small larvae. So they got all kinds of critters that feed on them.
Okay, that was what I wanted to know. Thank you so much.
All right, thanks a lot for calling. Phil, back to our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. We've got another photograph here from Jeff.
It's Pseudolucanus capreolus, which is the fancy name for a type of stag beetle that we have in the state. We have two species of stag beetles, and there are larger species in states south of us. Related to June beetles, the adults are found often at lights. That's what draws them in. The males have a very pronounced jaw on them. The females, similar shape and color, but a much smaller jaw on them. The grubs are found in rotting wood, so they're really pretty much harmless, but the adults give the impression of something from outer space. And I will say that I would not put my finger between the jaws because they'll give you a good pinch, but you basically have to do that. They're not really aggressive. They don't run over to bite you. As I said, they just kind of use that. It really probably more is for sexual recognition and the like rather than being a big defensive mechanism.
And Janice in Sturtevant, on to you. Hi, Janice.
Well, hi. I'm so happy to have an opportunity to talk to you. We have carpenter ants inside in the kitchen, and I was wondering what we should do about it.
Now, are these just a few black ants running around on the kitchen floor, or do you have signs that they are nesting in the house?
I don't have any signs that they're nesting in the house, other than originally we found about 15 ants or so in our cupboard where I keep things like sugar and such. So we cleaned out the cupboard, and we put down something called Toro Perimeter Ant Bait about 3 weeks ago and put it outside. And we also put it on the top of the cupboard, even though they told us not to put it in an area where food is prepared. But I did that anyway.
Mm-hmm.
We saw for about a week no ants. And then now they've gradually come back, and I see about three a day.
Okay. Well, the first thing is what you are seeing are sterile females, and so they don't pose a problem. They're looking for food, and the pattern to me suggests you're just getting ants that are nesting in a tree outside and coming in the kitchen because that's where they would find food, and so it's a nuisance.
We looked outside around on the trees. We don't have many trees. We only have three. Other than in the front, we have some small spruce-type trees. But anyway, we looked outside. We couldn't find any ants outside other than one or two.
Yeah, but see, one of the problems is they're more active at night. I mean, carpenter ants are really not that easy to detect the nest. And they could be in landscape timbers. They could be in your neighbor's property. I mean, we've seen them forage upwards of 70, 80 yards.
Okay.
One of the things that, I don't think you want to take it to this point, but some people at times will put something out for the carpenter ants to eat on purpose. So they, put some honey out on a dish, or honestly, the guy that originally did this used chopped up crickets because they love chopped up crickets. And what he'd do is he'd come at night with a flashlight and he'd follow the line of ants coming and going. And sometimes he would trail them way back into the woods, and that's where he would find the nest. Sometimes he would see the ants crawl up the side and go in the soffit, and then I know that they're nesting up there. And so it gets difficult. I mean, if you want to go through that kind of effort, as they said, you have to look at night, not during the day, and you have to provide them some food that they get excited about, that there's enough ant activity that you can trail them. But other than that, if you spray along the outside foundation, it repels the ants. It doesn't kill the colony. It just repels the ants so they stop coming in. The other thing I would be cautious of, if you've got any overhanging limbs and branches, that's often a way that the ants can get access to the house and never even crawl on the ground. And so we, try to keep those things away to cut down on that as a bridge activity. But, the mere presence, I've said on the show before, I think we made a mistake to name them carpenter ants, because the implication is they eat wood and make everything fall apart. And in nature, they nest in rotting stumps, and the only time they nest indoors is when they find an environment to their liking that has some kind of soft substrate. So if you saw the ants in your bedroom, I'd say, well, there's no food there, so that would suggest they're nesting indoors. If you saw a bunch of wing forms, they're associated with a nest, and if there's a bunch of wing forms inside, there's got to be a nest inside. As one of the callers earlier in the show had talked about, is seeing this sawdust-like residue. Well, that's a sign that they're nesting indoors. But ants in the kitchen, as I said, I think you're just recruiting them from outside, and they're trying to take advantage of any food they can find.
There you go. Thank you very much for calling. And Tyson wants to grow some soft-bodied insects to feed to some pinky-sized tree frogs. This is from our Facebook page. Any idea? I was thinking of fruit flies. I just put a banana. Do I just put a banana in a jar and wait for them to grow?
Well, that could go. But you know what they sell in the pet stores are wingless fruit flies. And so they can't get away. And so you can raise the same type of thing. So there's an advantage to that versus the regular fruit flies. As they transform in their life cycle, you'll get adults and they're going to be flying all around the kitchen. But fruit flies breed on the yeast associated with decay. And so that's what happens when the banana gets ripe and has fallen and get mushy. That's what draws them in. They lay their eggs and you get these little tiny white maggots. And the cycle goes through very quickly. I mean, you can push them in about 10 days. And so, yes, if you leave a food source out, and I would leave it outside because there's lots of fruit flies outside. You need some moisture, though. You can't let it totally dry out. But do consider just checking with the local pet stores to see if they've got some wingless varieties, because they're a lot easier to rear.
And you can get them to breed and raise more of them?
Same thing. You just use some of the table scraps that are fruits and vegetables even potentially, although vegetables may have a little bit more of an odor problem. Or again, get the discount of bananas at the store, because, boy, you can breed an awful lot of fruit flies off of one banana.
And getting rid of safely spiders from the kitchen? Is it the vacuum cleaner?
I think so. Or, individual spiders you can always catch in a jar. They'll trick you. Put the jar over them. You slip a piece of paper under the jar so it's trapped in there, and then you can go take them outside and let them go on their way.
I have a spider in the side mirror of my car. Every year, it's got to be a different spider, but it comes out, and it's got a little web. And it always rides when I'm driving. It comes out.
Well, probably the air movement has got it all excited, thinking that there's something to feed on. One would wonder, it's probably slim pickings in a car to get stuff. Plus now, this kind of weather, you wonder if it's getting so hot that the spider might even succumb to heat exhaustion. But.
Well, it's a lot of fun, and every year it's the same looking spider, but it's always in that side mirror. Phil, always a great pleasure. Thank you so much.
Definitely.
Phil will be back. Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist, our guest. We were watching that spider fly around this morning, my daughter and I, on the way to her camp. Tomorrow at 11, Sue Nitzke joins us, nutritionist, talk about a study on potatoes' impact on our waistline. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network.